started a series on the life of St. Peter. And we talked a little bit about why Peter, and you can go listen to the podcast if you want all that. I really need to get going because last service, we only went over by about 20 minutes. So trying to trim things down, and they're yakety-yak. So this morning, we're turning to one of, really one of the most famous episodes in the life of Peter. If you've been in church for any amount of time, if you've sat through a Sunday school or VBS, this story is a popular one, all right? Because in it, we get a storm, and we get the disciples in a boat, and then Peter jumps out and walks on water, and then he starts to go under, and he calls out for Jesus to save him. This is a mosaic from the old St. Peter's Basilica. It's a copy. It's not the actual mosaic. Duh. I don't know why we feel the need to say that it's a copy. Clearly, it's not the real mosaic on the screen. So what we're going to do this morning is, because it's such a familiar story to us, we often come at stories in our post-Enlightenment world with this idea. I was taught in seminary to preach this way. I was taught to study the passage all week and then to figure out the big idea. Singular, the big idea. What is this story about? And then to tell you all what it's about, and then we leave. But if you would go back many years and or even current and talk to maybe some rabbis, they would say that's the wrong approach entirely to a story. That what you do with a story is instead what you would do at home when you get out all your loose diamonds and you start playing with your loose diamonds like I do on a regular basis. And you hold that diamond up to the light. And as you turn it, it reflects the light differently. And as each facet hits the light, different colors, different nuances, different things come out. And so when the rabbis talk about this, the Hebrew scriptures, they talk about it that way, that you keep turning the scripture. You keep looking at it from new ways, new lenses, new understandings. And as we keep turning it, we understand it differently and in a new ways. So what we're going to do this morning is an exercise in that. We're going to turn this passage several times. And the way we're going to do it is this. We're going to narrow in on each of the three central characters in this story. And we're going to go through this. I'm going to read it three times. And after each reading, I'm going to ask you to reflect on that particular reading. So in the first reading, we're going to reflect on Jesus. And we're going to talk about the passage in terms of, if you're Jesus in this story, what are you thinking? And how is Jesus acting in this passage? And then we're going to read it again, and we're going to talk about the disciples. And we're going to talk about maybe what we can learn or glean from a disciple-centric reading. And then the last section we're going to do, we're going to spend time on Peter, since he's the one we're supposed to be doing. We're going to try to go through the first two rather quickly and then give ourselves a fair amount of time to talk about Peter. Does that everybody understand what we're going to do? So if you want to follow along in your Bible, it's page 796. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 14. While you're turning there, let me just point out one curiosity. If you are looking through your Bible, you'll find this story also in Mark's gospel. The interesting thing about Mark's gospel is he tells this story but leaves out everything about Peter. He tells the story that they were out in the water. They get to Jesus walking on water, and they were all afraid. And then in Mark's telling of it, Jesus gets in the boat, calms the water, story over. Mark leaves out Peter entirely, which is curious. Anybody have a theory why? Bitter jealousy. Mark hated Peter. No, I'm kidding. You're right on. Historically speaking, many people think Mark was one of Peter's disciples. And so when Mark writes, if you've ever read the Gospel of John, John does this. He refers to himself as like the disciple Jesus loved. He never calls himself out directly. And they think maybe that's one of the things that's happening here, is because Mark is a disciple of Peter, that maybe he tells a story but doesn't want to highlight his role in it. So he diminishes his role, which is just really, it doesn't really fit anywhere else in the message. It's just interesting. And I thought I'd let you all know that. So, Mark chapter 14, we're going to get the one that actually mentions Peter. It says this: immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went on a mountainside by himself to pray, and later that night he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake, and when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and they cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, any passage that starts with the word "immediately" ought to drive us backwards in the text to say, okay, well, if Mark is making the point that this happened immediately after what was preceding it, we probably ought to go back and see what was preceding it. So let me set up the context for just a minute, and then we'll reflect on Jesus in this story. If you flip the page backwards one, and on the right column there on page 7 to 95, we get the heading, "A Prophet Without Honor." Now, if you look across the rest of the page, you see that Jesus has been teaching in a bunch of parables to people. And then it says this: when Jesus had finished teaching these parables, he moved on from there. And coming to his hometown, so he's coming into Nazareth, he began teaching the people in their synagogue. And they were amazed. "Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers?" they asked. "Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? And aren't his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas? Aren't all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own town and in his own home." And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. So, to set the stage for Jesus walking on water, understand, he's just gone to his hometown recently and basically been rejected in his hometown, because kind of like this thing. Have you ever met somebody that you haven't seen in years and years, and they do that like awkward, like, "I changed your diapers when I was your kid," when you were a kid, not when I was a kid. That's really weird. That kind of thing where, like, it doesn't matter how much your achievements are out in the world. When you go home, you're just that person that picked his nose in fourth grade. Like, whatever the thing is, like, you'll just be defined by that. And that's what happens to Jesus, not the nose-picking thing. But the, like, we know him. We know his family. We know his mother. We knew his dad. He's a carpenter. Like, why? And so, basically, Jesus has said, that's it. Hometown, done. Not going back there. So there's an emotional cost to Jesus there. And then in the next paragraph, if you look at the beginning of chapter 14, it says this: at that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus, and he said, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead. That is why miraculous powers are at work in him." And then Matthew tells us the story of what Herod did to John. And what did Herod do to John? It says it in the page. Everybody's doing the motion. He cut off his head. Yes. So if you're Jesus, you're rejected in your hometown, and you find out that Herod now is aware of who you are and thinks you're the guy that he killed, which is not a good place to be. "I killed this guy." What Herod thinks is Jesus is the reincarnation of John. And so if Herod beheaded John, watch out. So you've got that going on in the background for Jesus as well. Then we get to this passage. So when Jesus heard what had happened, so when he heard about John and all that and Herod, he withdrew. This is verse 13, by the way. He withdrew by a boat privately to a solitary place. And hearing of this, the crowds, as all crowds do, followed him on foot from the towns. So Jesus hears about this stuff happening. His hometown rejects him. Herod's after him. His cousin John has been beheaded. And Jesus says, whoa, this is a big time in my life. I should retreat. I should get away from things. I should kind of deal with my stuff. And the crowds go, oh no, we're coming with you too. So wherever you're going, we're going to follow you into that. So when he needs rest, he's followed by the crowds. And I don't know about you. I'm an extrovert. I like being around people. I told Jennifer yesterday, part of what I love about Steamboat Weekend is I spend many hours running alone. It's just fun to run with people. I like being with people. But I can tell you that on Sundays, about an hour from now, I'm done with people, right? Like, I've had a fill of people for the day, and I'm ready to go home and spend the afternoon napping and in general being a bad father on Father's Day, because I'm tired and I fall asleep easily on Sundays because I'm tired. And so this is the context. And in that context, then Jesus keeps teaching, feeds 5,000. And it's at the end of that that we get to this immediately in Matthew 14:22, where Jesus made the disciples get into the boat to go ahead of him while he dismissed the crowd. Puts the disciples in a boat, says, go on across, says to the crowd, it's over, go away, nothing more to see, leave me alone. That's where we set up. So when we read this passage, if we're going to think about what we see from Jesus or learn, what do we learn from Jesus in this passage of Peter walking on water? If we're going to turn the passage, what do we learn from Jesus? He needs time alone. This is, for me, the first thing I wrote down when I was looking at this passage the other day, is first thing, the rhythms that Jesus lives in. This recognition in Jesus' life, wow, this is a busy season, I need to withdraw. I have to say, this is hard for me. I'd say maybe something I'm learning in my life. I was thinking back to when I first started out in ministry, and I was out of seminary. I was 25, and I was a youth pastor. And back in those days, before we had kids, I think it was pretty normal for me to work 60 or 70 hours a week, have kids over to our house 5 nights a week, and just be going all the time. Go, 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 go. And I've started to notice as I've gotten older that I can't do that anymore. I just get tired. And so, like, just recently, I had a stretch, and I think I shared this all with you a couple weeks ago. I had a week where within a 7-day span, I preached at 2 funerals, preached here on a Sunday morning, taught a Sunday school class between churches, and then turned around on that same Sunday and did a wedding here. So two funerals, weddings, sermons on Sunday morning in a 7-day span. And earlier in my life, I would have just kept charging, like, oh, that's just what it is. Keep going, keep moving. And I actually, maybe for the first time ever, had the smarts after that. Like, I didn't come into the office for a couple days. Like, I took a couple days off and worked in the yard and just mostly alone out in the yard with the neighbor's dog barking at me. Because I recognize I need those rhythms, just like Jesus needs the rhythm of being with people, being alone, serving people, being alone, personal crisis things happen, I need to be alone. That rhythm of being with and being alone is important. And we just see that throughout the scriptures. That's good. What else? Somebody else was over here. What else do we learn from Jesus in this passage? Or what else do we see? What else? What are the questions? What's curious about Jesus in this passage? Besides the fact that he's walking on water. Yeah. Yeah, so it's an affirmation of, even though somebody said in the first service, if you read the stories coming up to it, it seems like things are getting out of control. Herod's upset, John's dead, rejected in the hometown, all those things are a little chaotic. And then we get this story of, no, got it. Things are under control. And I should have mentioned too, this isn't the first story of Jesus calming waters. There's another story of Jesus calming waters in which the boat was going crazy and Jesus was doing what? Do you remember this one? Jesus is sleeping in the boat, and that happens in Matthew's narrative. That happens in Matthew 8, several chapters before. So this isn't the first time the disciples have been on a boat where there's a big storm. That one, the one I like to picture Jesus waking up and, like, wiping the drool, like, you know, like, oh, storm, be calm, and it's done. You know, like that, that's what happened that time. So they're kind of a similar scenario. They're back in this again, but Jesus reasserting, don't worry about it, I've got it. What else? Yes, yes. Yeah, so the response, and that's jumping ahead to the disciples, but the disciples' response to Jesus at the end of this is, hometown doesn't recognize who he is, Herod misunderstands who he is, the crowds don't often get it, but his disciples at some level get something here. And it says they worship him, calling him the Son of God, which they may not all understand in its fullest extent, they may not know exactly what's going on, but something happens here and they get something like, whoa, this is bigger beyond, yeah, good. Hey, anything else? Go ahead. Yeah, so that rhythm is, if we want to really lean into that idea of Jesus and rhythms, it never goes that well. And I'll tell you in personal experience, it doesn't go that well. As soon as you say, I do this all the time. I'm going to leave this day on my calendar and I'm going to take this day to retreat away. That is the day that everybody starts calling and saying, hey, can you do this meeting this day? Can I call you? Can we do this thing? Like it's hard. You have to fight for those rhythms and you see Jesus in some ways fighting for it. I'm going to do it. It didn't work. I'm going to do it again. Oh, I should have flipped the slide to Jesus. All right. Let me ask you one question, and I'll ask it. It might lead us down a path for a minute. When Jesus says to Peter, what are the exact words? Immediately Jesus says to him and caught him, reaches out his hand, caught him, "You of little faith, why do you doubt?" What's your mental picture there? How do you picture Jesus saying that? Yeah. Okay, we'll get to the disciples in just a minute, but it doesn't seem like Peter's the one of little faith. If there's a ranking of faith in this whole thing, they seem to be lower on the pecking order. Yes. How do you picture Jesus? What's his face look like? How does he say it? Yeah, so disappointed. That word comes up a lot. Yes. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, when you're the Son of God, this is just what you do. And so you see Jesus as very calm in this moment, not chastising necessarily, but this is just what I do, and you're not there yet. Ooh, disappointed for Peter, then disappointed in Peter. That's really well said. Nobody said that in the first service. If I had a treat, I'd throw it to you. I went to the zoo last week, and they throw treats to the seals. Maybe we should start doing that. I'll throw fish at people. Somebody else, that's really good, yeah. Yes. Yeah. No matter how much faith Peter musters up, it's little in some respects. Yeah. Because it took a huge amount of faith to get out. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus is the word here, that word doubt, is the word means to be of two minds. So Jesus' question, why were you of two minds about this? Then initially, Peter gets in the boat, and I'm just going to say this, and then we're going to set it aside and come back to it. But Peter gets out of the boat, and he's of one mind. If you're walking on water, I'll walk on water. And then he sees the wind, and whatever Peter gets full of doubt about, which we're going to come back to again later, he gets of two minds. He starts second-guessing what's happening. He starts thinking about it too much. It's like, you know, when your kid first starts riding their bike, and they're not thinking about it? You've let go of the seat, and they don't know it, and they're just cruising along, and then they realize you're not holding the seat anymore, and they become of two minds, right? They're aware now of, whoa! You know, like, yeah, you've been going for a while. I haven't been doing anything. Or they're all old enough, it doesn't matter anymore. We just kept shortening their training wheels. So I just keep moving them up more and more till eventually they weren't even hardly using them. They'd just be riding down the street, like the occasional, like they'd tip over. But so that when we took them off, it was like, well, duh, you've been kind of doing this for a while. You just didn't think about it. So that's a good parenting tip for anyone else. Just keep shortening the training wheels and eventually they don't need them. All right. Anything else about Jesus, real quick, before we move to the disciples? Ariana, that's a great question, and I don't have the answer to it. Did he expect the other disciples to also walk on the water? I'm going to say I don't think so, and I'll explain why when we get to Peter, okay? Let me answer this question for me, my answer to this question. I'm with you, Taylor. I've never seen, the first service really saw this in very negative light, that Jesus was chastising, he was disappointed, maybe angry at Peter. They really, unduly negative. And I was trying, it's like, lighten up, people drink coffee, sleep in, like the second service. But I was saying to them, I find in Jesus, one, a lot of compassion here, because the response of Jesus when Peter's drowning is that immediately he reaches down. He doesn't let him flounder. The come, and we're going to talk about that when we get to Peter a little bit, that there's an invitation to it. I don't think, he's not saying you have no faith. He's not saying don't ever do this again. How arrogant of you. But at the same way, I was trying to think of, between services, I was trying to think of an analogy, and this is not perfect. But say, I'm working on a project at home and I'm nailing a nail, and my kids, as they often do, want to do that very thing. And so they say, can I drive this nail? And I say, well, sure, go ahead. Here's the hammer. And let's say they swing the first time and they hit it and that's good. And then they swing the second time and miss it. And I say to them, oh, you of little hammering skills, why do you not have faith that you can do this? I don't talk in Jesus-isms to my kids. But I'm just saying, like, I'm not disappointed. I'm kind of glad that they even tried and that they got it a little bit, and they just don't have the skill to do this kind of thing yet. They haven't gotten there yet. But, you know, so I just don't read it that way. And I always tend to see Jesus as being a lot more gracious than I think we often paint him to be. And so I have a hard time picturing him being anything else but kind. And because I and we all read our own personalities into Jesus, that I read my own personality into this, and I think that there's a lot of humor in all of this, and I hope that years later, around the campfire, the other disciples made fun of Peter, and that even Jesus joined in with. Remember that time you walked on water? And then you got nervous. You should have seen the look on your face. It was hilarious. I choose to believe that's what happened, all right? There's no evidence at all that that's what they did, but let's talk about the disciples. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples, and we don't know if it's all the disciples or some of the disciples, but at least there's a collection of disciples that got into the boat and went on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. And after he dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. And later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance. Some people think 2 to 4 miles from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. And shortly before dawn, which means that the disciples may have been at the oars as many as 6 to 8 hours of rowing into hard winds and rains and waves, Jesus went out to them walking on a lake. And when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost. The Greek here is phantasm, where we get the word fan, like a phantom. In fact, what we think is that what they would have perceived is that they saw something that looked like Jesus. It's not that they don't recognize Jesus, but that they don't recognize Jesus as being in bodily form. So they're scared because why is the guy we just left on the shore now a ghost walking on the water? And why is there a ghost walking on water? And what's happening? And so they're terrified. Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It's me, real me. Don't be afraid." Then Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he says. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat, the disciples, they worshiped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." So what do we learn from the disciples in this? We've hinted at a couple things. What do we get from the disciples? What do we learn from them? Do we admire them? Do we not admire them? What, are they heroes in this story? Are they goats? Sometimes in the telling of this story, I've heard this story told in ways that make the disciples seem like they're the heroes in some way, that Peter was impulsive. There goes Peter again, being impulsive, jumping out of a boat that was perfectly fine. Like, what's his problem? And so the unintended teaching then is what you should do is just stay in the boat. And I'm going to tell you, I don't think that's the story either. What do we think of the disciples? What do we learn from them? Anything? So perhaps one way of looking at it is that they just don't have the faith to do this, that they should have had a spontaneous all 12 of them jumping out at the same time. Yeah, there goes Peter. I mean, after him. Yeah, right. He asked first. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. Yes. It's frightening, and maybe they're just, I think, stupefied, dumbfounded. They're just in awe. Where do the disciples get in this passage? This is what's so fascinating. Where do they get? What's the end of this passage? Yeah, we think sometimes in terms of it finally dawns on them, but like the real dawn, the lights are coming on for the disciples. This is halfway through Matthew's gospel, actually right at the halfway point. And this in Matthew's story, by the way, is kind of the high point for the disciples. This is their crowning moment when the lights are starting to come on. His hometown doesn't get it. Herod doesn't get it. But they're starting to get it. And we don't know at what level they actually are getting it until post-resurrection. And they all start changing the world, and they start writing things. But something's happening where they see this event, and they go, something's going on here that's bigger than just he's a good teacher and can heal some people. So something big's happening. Yeah. I'm gonna point to this in just a minute, but I want to highlight what you just said, that maybe they were doing exactly what they were supposed to do, and Peter was doing exactly what Peter was supposed to do. And sometimes we come to stories or we come to our own experiences and we want to make it all about my story, that everybody has to go through the same hoops I did and do it the same way I did. And if I'm giving up chocolate for Lent, everybody ought to give up chocolate and be grouchy during Lent, just like I am, because that's what's right. And if I'm going to fast, everybody's going to fast. And if I'm going to choose X, Y, and Z, everybody must choose this. And yet, maybe in stories like this, we find these hints in the gospel that what Peter needs to do, and we get this episode with Peter much later in his life where, well, how was he going to die? Well, don't worry about him and how he's going to die. That's from John 21. Don't worry about how he's going to die. you and I, we'll talk about you and I. And so I'm going to point in just a minute to maybe the good reasons why Peter got out of the boat and why Peter was supposed to be the one to get out of the boat. And maybe they weren't supposed to be doing that. It's good. Come more. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great way of thinking it. I don't know if you heard this, but maybe they're like the chorus in a Greek play where they're the normal. They're the way all of us respond so that it highlights how out there, literally out there, Peter is, or it highlights what's important about this interchange. They're there to let us know this is what the rest of us would do. This is what normal people do. When normal people see a phantasm walking on the water in a big, big dark storm, you stay in the boat. And you might pull the covers over your head because then it can't hurt you, right? Like that's it, okay? Yeah, cool. Yeah, because it doesn't necessarily paint Peter in a good light, and it's confusing, and yeah, easy. All right, I'm going to skip a quote that I was going to read to you because I want to get to this. All right, Peter. So I'm not going to read the passage again for sake of time. We got the idea of the passage. We know the story. Let me start by laying out maybe some good reasons for getting out of a boat that makes sense, at least to Peter. All right? I've always heard this story in terms of Peter spontaneously did something that's either beautiful or crazy, depending on who's teaching. But it's always painted in terms of this is kind of a spontaneous act. And I don't think this is necessarily as spontaneous as we make it out to be. I think it's a little bit more calculated and a little bit more intentional than that. First of all, we need to understand, if we go back to last week, when Jesus called Peter, what are the words Jesus used to Peter? Drop your nets and follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. So the first thing Peter understands about the assignment and the trajectory of his life is, what is his life supposed to be about? Following Jesus. What is Jesus doing right now? Walking on water. So if you're following Jesus, and Jesus is walking on water, what are you supposed to do if your job is to follow Jesus? Walk on the water. And especially if we put the two accounts together and Jesus was just going to walk him by, like, wait a minute, wherever he's going, somebody in the first service said, and I think this is good, his options aren't great. He's in a boat that's been fighting waves for 8 hours, or Jesus walking on water on by. Where do you want to be? All right? And if your job, if you see your life's calling now, I'm supposed to be following Jesus and Jesus is walking on water, you walk on water. And to push that point even further, if we went back a couple chapters to Matthew 10, in Matthew 10, Jesus takes his disciples in, and we often think of Jesus' whole ministry as being him surrounded by his secret service agents, disciples. But that's not what it looked like. Jesus calls the disciples, he does ministry with his disciples, and then Jesus says to his disciples in Matthew 10, he brings them in and says, listen, I want you to go out in pairs, and I want you to go into the towns, and I want you to teach, and I want you to heal, and I want you to do the ministry you see me doing. And so they do. They go out into the towns, and you could read that in Matthew 10, and then they come back and report to Jesus the things that they did and the things that they experienced. Jesus is intentionally training his disciples to emulate Jesus' ministry. So in Peter's mind, Jesus is walking by. He knows he's supposed to follow Jesus. Jesus has taught him to do everything Jesus has done so far. He's taught his disciples to do. And now Jesus seems to be walking on water. So I suppose this is how we roll now. We don't use boats. Like, part of this whole, we're healing. We didn't do healings before. We're teaching. We didn't teach before. I was just a fisherman. And now Jesus is walking on water. And apparently that's what we do now too. And then finally, one of the things I said last week. Oh, let me just say this too. In that part in verse 28 where he says, Lord, if it's you. In the English, we hear if is conditional. And it's probably not. It's more likely that what's happening there is he's saying, since it was you. Because the way it sets up, it almost sounds like Peter's challenging Jesus. Like, yeah, if it's really you, show me who you are. But that's probably not. The Greek construction allows for at least to be, since it's you. So you say that you're out there. Since it's you doing this, you have the power to make me do this as well. Finally, we said last week that when the disciples are listed, who's always listed first? Yeah, the answer in this case is Peter, not Jesus, all right? I'm just going to give you a heads up. There's some more of these. The answer is going to be Peter. When the disciples speak, who's their spokesperson every time? when Jesus talks to an individual, I think, now this one I might be wrong on, but I think every time, either says Jesus talks to the disciples, but if it ever singles out a disciple, who's he talking to? Yeah, right. And so, and I think there's like 14 times in the Bible or something like that where Peter and Jesus are having a conversation more than anybody else by far. Who's the leader of the early church? Who leads the church into Gentiles and Jews together? Who gets the vision of the sheet descending? Who's the leader in Acts 15? Like, if you start looking through, and I said this last week, but as Protestants, we're so afraid of giving the Catholics any ground on Peter that we diminish Peter's role, but the pages of scriptures are pretty clear. Peter seems to be the leader among the disciples. And if you're the lead disciple here and your rabbi now is walking on the water, if you're one of the 12 in the boat, and let's say they're all there, whose job is it to be the first to follow? It's Peter's. Maybe Peter isn't being as irrational as we think we are. Maybe Peter is doing exactly the thing he's supposed to do as the lead disciple. If you're the first of the disciples, if you're the one that's supposed to follow him first, if you're supposed to be the example for others, if you have this connection to Jesus that we talked about last week and we'll talk about again in 2 weeks that the others didn't quite have, then maybe this is exactly the thing you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get out of the boat. You're supposed to follow Jesus on the water. Maybe it's not crazy at all. But then he does, and that's remarkable and all those things, and so he gets out. And oh, the other thing, somebody asked in the earlier service, isn't this just hubris on Peter's part? Isn't he just being arrogant? Like, look what I did, ha-ha. But what's interesting is that he then asks Jesus for permission. Can I? May I? And Jesus encourages the behavior. Jesus invites him. Yeah, if you want to do this, do this. And then the text tells us he gets out of the boat, he walks on the water, and he comes towards Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he's afraid and beginning to sink. Now, we don't know how far Jesus was away from the boat. We don't know how far Jesus walked. And we don't know how far Jesus or Peter sank. All right? He may have been getting up to his knees. He may have been, you know, like this. What we do know is that Peter was, in all likelihood, a very strong swimmer. Part of what it meant to be a fisherman is that he would have been jumping in the water on a regular basis. The way fishermen fished back then required them to swim. Somebody had to jump in and draw the nets. And we see in the John 21 passage that Peter jumps out of a boat out in the ocean and, or out in the sea and swims in and then wades into Jesus. So Peter's not afraid of the water. Some of us don't get this. You know, being from Illinois, you know, I think I've shared with you all, I did my first triathlon last year and I was swimming in a lake in Canton and I got to the first buoy and all I could think was sharks. And I know that's super not rational, right? So I got my mind off sharks and it landed squarely on crocodiles and alligators and such. And then I even worked on the mental start of that and then I just got to snapping turtles and in my head snapping turtles were like this big in this lake, right? And so I was, there were really old people passing me. It was really, really embarrassing. I can't tell you how embarrassing it was. So I don't get this whole freedom of jumping in the ocean thing. Jennifer, when we go on vacation, swims out to the buoy. Just makes me a little nervous. I've seen Jaws. and feet dangling is exactly what the sharks are looking for. But Peter is not that guy. His life is lived in the ocean, or in the sea, at least in this case. And so Peter's ability to swim, I have full confidence in. And yet Peter recognized that he was starting to lose his footing on top of the water, and he starts to go down and he cries out to Jesus. And oftentimes, I think that when we've played Peter in our life, we've expected to get chided a little bit. Like when this is not a particularly great moment of parenting, but we all do it, I think. Or maybe I'm just talking about my garbage. But, you know, our kid tries something and they don't do it really well. And I want to take this opportunity to teach you a few things. Yes, I'm going to give you a hand. I'm going to help you out. I'll get you out of this scrape. But let's talk about it first. And let's talk about the lessons you can learn. And Jesus could have easily said, you know what, well, since you're going under, let's talk about a few things about the next time you decide to walk on water or do something like this, or let's talk about your lack of faith. But the text tells us that Jesus' response is immediate. And that at whatever level Peter recognized that he was going under, he cries out. And somebody came up to me after the first service. They said, isn't it interesting that I often wait till I'm drowning, I'm well underwater, before I ask for help? And it says here that Jesus, or Peter, begins to notice that he was sinking. And that's when he cries out, Jesus, save me. And it's at that moment he recognizes it right away, that this started out well. And it's like the, you know, the walking down the stair trick, you know, like that's how I picture it happening. Like, uh-oh. And Jesus immediately responds. And then Jesus lobs this question out there, and the question is, why did you doubt? There's a lot of answers to this, and I don't know that we have any definitive answers. Some people say that Peter doubted himself. He doubted his ability to keep following Jesus in this manner. All right, there we are. Thank you. That's nice having him up there, right, Brian? You can just send him up. Go! A sound lackey. There's some people that believe Jesus, or that Peter doubted himself. There's some people that think that Peter doubted Jesus. There's some people that think he didn't doubt either one of those things, that he was fully confident in himself and fully confident in Jesus, but there was this other thing of which he was of two minds. We don't know exactly why Peter doubts, but I think this question is an interesting one. It gets hung over us, like, why do we do the exact same thing? Why do we begin to follow Jesus and then we doubt? Why do we begin to do anything and then we doubt? And it leads us to these places of reflection, of looking back and asking ourselves. I think this question is a devotional question. This is the kind of question that when you go into silence and you retreat, you sit and you sit with this one. Like, why am I of two minds? We do this in a lot of different ways. I'll use one of my own examples. This spring I did a marathon, you all know, or most of you know. And so, you know, in January when you sign up, that's exciting when you sign up, all right? Because it's pretty simple. Click, 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 credit card, click, you know, like done. And then, you know, the first couple weeks, it's kind of fun. You know, you run 12, 15 miles a week, and it's kind of fun, and it's kind of enjoyable, and you feel like you're on terra firma. And then there comes a point where you clearly get of two minds, and especially when you're running a marathon in April, and it's February, and there's snow on the ground, and there's, like, it's raining, and you're running, and your mileage now is up to 35, 40 miles a week, and it's cold. And there was one morning, I remember this winter, it was in February, and I had to do 7 miles, and we were leaving to go somewhere, so I had to do 7 miles at, like, 6 a.m. in February, and it's still dark then. And I had worn like a neck gaiter thing because the outside temperature was 7 degrees or 6 degrees or something. And I learned that after about 6 miles of running that way, it was the neck thing around me was like rock hard. It had frozen solid around my neck, and I couldn't breathe anymore because it was like breathing through a shield of ice. So that's the limit. That's a bad place. That's a bad moment. And of that, in that moment, if you'd asked me, like, how excited are you about running a marathon, I was of two minds. And my mind was much more on the waves and the wind than on the goal ahead, because that's the way we do things. We start off and things seem easy and right and good, like I am going to build a new deck. And then we realize somewhere along the way that, oh, wow, this is harder than I thought. Or I'm going to make this huge meal by myself. And then we get into it and realize, oh, no, if I can just get something on the table, that's good. Or we decide I'm going to start this ambitious new ministry or this new thing, and then it gets hard along the way, and we begin to doubt either ourselves or the circumstances or that God will sustain us in this thing. Which brings me to where I really think, I think this passage is largely about to me. I don't think it's necessarily the big idea, but it's a big idea for me, and it has to do with fear and failure and risk. We're addicted in our culture to stories of success, and it's not just our culture, it's every culture. We tell stories of victorious heroes. Nobody says, hey kids, gather around, let me tell you about the story about the guy who was a big failure his whole life. Like, nobody wants to hear that, right? We love stories of success, and what we want to believe, especially in the American mythological thing, we want to believe that somebody had one great idea, and they cashed that idea in. Henry Ford had an idea about an assembly line, and the Model T, and da-da-da-da-da. And we don't often spend much time talking about failure. We don't celebrate failure, and yet, this story, in some ways, to me, is about the celebration of failure. about those times when we try to follow Jesus and we start out and then it doesn't work and Jesus says, you have little faith, and he puts us back in the boat. But that's not the end of Peter's story, by far. This is the same Peter who tradition tells us, and we'll get to this late in July, actually first week of August, I think. This is the same Peter who history tells us eventually moved to Rome. And we believe that Peter was crucified and at his own request was crucified upside down because he thought himself to be unworthy to be crucified in the same way as his master. This is not a guy who had no faith. And this event did not become Peter's defining moment in any way, shape, or form. This is just a moment that was a step in the journey to being the kind of person. I don't know about any of us. I don't know if I said this morning, who thinks right now they had have the faith to follow Jesus into that kind of death? I think if all of us were honest, we'd gulp real big and go, yeah, I'm going to sit in the boat on that one. And yet Peter, in these big moments, especially later and later in his life, becomes incredible, the things he does. And so this episode just becomes an episode in Peter's life. There's that story about the Thomas Edison story, right? You've all heard this about Thomas Edison created 20 bajillion light bulbs that didn't work. You know, the number's always different. It depends on who's telling. And they asked him, like, what's the question? Like, what about all those? And he said, I learned, you know, 20 bajillion ways of not to build a light bulb. And that's like the one story I could think of where we celebrate those kinds of things, that maybe sometimes the only way to really follow is to fail a lot. And even in our failures, Jesus lifts us up and puts out a hand and sets us back in the boat, and we come to some new understanding. There's this story, it's a kind of a famous psychological story, experiment thing, where they took two groups of ceramics classes. It was a ceramics class. They divided it in half, and they told half the students that we want you to create as much pottery as you can in the next whatever period of time, let's say 7 days. As much pottery as you can. You will be graded on how much you can produce in the next 7 days. 50 pieces, an A. 40 pieces, a B. You know, whatever. Something like that. That's what they did. To the other half, the other group, they said, you'll have the same period of time. You'll have 1 week. And we want you to create one piece, the best possible thing you can create. At the end, and we'll give you a grade based on the quality of your piece. So they did that. At the end of the whole study, you know where the most quality of pieces came from? The group that did the most, not the group that planned to do the best pieces. It's the group that kept on trying, and they didn't really care about the quality because they were just churning it out. But something about the doing and the failing and just the process, they got better and better and better. They say that great writers just write a lot, and most of it you'll never see because it's garbage. That great musicians write just a lot of music, and most of it will never see the light of day because it's just not worth getting to the light of day. That there's something about the failing, that in the failing, we find the things that really succeed. And so maybe what I get from this story, at least this time working through it, is maybe instead of failures being that thing that we run away from, that maybe failure should be embraced as part of what it means to follow Jesus. That this is what it is to follow Jesus, that he calls us out of the boat. And I don't know what your calling out of the boat is. I barely know sometimes when I'm being called out of the boat, but maybe there's times where we're called out of the boat and we really don't have any other choice to do so, and we're going to fail, and we know we're going to fail, but that's part of what it is. And it's in the failing, and it's the trying and doing it again and learning the lesson and doing it again and failing again and failing again. And Jesus, in my head, Jesus smiles at us when we say, I failed again, help save me, that's where Jesus, to me, smiles and puts out his hand and lifts us up and puts us in the boat and then takes care and says, be calm. And it's those moments, to me, that Jesus is worthy to be worshipped. Sometimes I think we get it really backwards when we think that God is this harsh, that Jesus is this harsh, demanding taskmaster, like, you idiot. You can only get halfway to me on the water, and here I am waltzing across the whole lake. And yet I don't believe that's the picture that we get of Jesus. I don't believe it's the picture we get of God. but rather that Jesus embraces our failure too. And this is the disciple that Jesus uses over and over again. And so, here's your invitation this morning, and then I'll pray. The invitation is to fail, to find the things that are worth failing about. You know, I'll tell you, there's times where I've stood up here before you all and taught, and then I don't say this publicly, but I go to my office, I'm like, well, that was a failure. That idea didn't work. That didn't preach very well. And that's the truth of it. There's weeks where it's a dud. Can we all be honest about that? I preach duds sometimes, all right? Maybe more times than there's good ones. There's once in a while that I'm like, oh, that one's good. But most of the time, not so much. You've got to feel like that about songs you write, right? Like, most of the time, all of them, yeah. It's really way more that I feel like we're duds than we're good. But then there's those moments where, I remember you wrote something a year or so ago, or not even maybe a year ago, and you let it, and people just start spontaneously singing in such a way that I was like, do they all know this song and I don't know it? Because people just, it was good, but I'm sure for that one, there's lots of others that were real stinkers. And so maybe that's it. Maybe Jesus embraces the stinkers. And in the doing of those, and all the misshapen, all the broken ones, that's how we find the things that are truly excellent and really become the kind of disciples that Peter actually eventually became. Let's pray.